From NPR and WBUR, I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Jane Clayson in Boston. This is Here and Now. President Biden is asking Congress for an additional $33 billion in aid for Ukraine. Biden spoke this morning about his request, which is more than double what Congress has already authorized.
The cost of this fight is not cheap, but caving to aggression is going to be more costly if we allow it to happen.
Biden's ask comes as the European Union is considering additional measures against Russia, which cut off gas exports to Poland and Bulgaria yesterday. NPR's Frank Langfitt joins us now from Kyiv. Hi, Frank. Good to have you.
Great to be here, Jane.
The EU has called Russia's decision to cut off gas from Poland and Bulgaria blackmail. What are European leaders doing in response to this latest action?
Well, what they're saying is that this isn't really going to work. And they're saying it's going to accelerate the EU's transition away from Russian energy. European Council President Charles Michel, he said, we're going to remain united and support each other while phasing out these energy imports. And this happened because these countries are refusing to pay in rubles, which is what Russia wants to prop up its currency. It's going to be very interesting to see if Russia does this to other countries, especially as the economies of Europe, things get tougher there because of rising inflation. That said, you know, there are at least four European gas buyers that made payments to Gazprom, that's the energy giant in Russia, in rubles. It's according to Bloomberg. And Hungary has said earlier this month it would pay for Russian natural gas in rubles as well.
And Frank, you've also been reporting on Russia's broader strategy. What are their goals for this phase in the war right now?
Well, right now, we're all watching the east, southeast, really the Donbass area, where Russia has finally concentrated its forces. You know, in the beginning, when it came, it was this multi-pronged attack, and that failed for a variety of reasons. I was talking to a guy named Oleg Ignatov. He's researches Russia for the International Crisis Group. They're a global think tank that focuses on security issues. And this is what he said.
The goal of Russia right now is to control more territories as it can. And maybe to annex these territories in future, because for Russian citizens, it will look like a victory, yes, because their plan to transform Ukraine into a pro-Russian state failed.
And how does that fit in with Putin's global objectives, Frank?
A lot of this is really, as he was, Oleg was saying, this is about domestic politics. The other thing, though, is that he'd like to be able to have as much territory as possible here so that maybe, you know, in a year or two, he could take more and more. His ultimate goal here, I think, was to have a pro-Russian government. That's not going to happen, but he can kind of disable this state and build it to some degree as a buffer state to feel some protection from NATO, which is the reason that he said, one of the reasons he said that he sent troops in here was to prevent Ukraine from joining NATO.
And Frank, Russia has controlled the southern city of Kherson since March, and now Russia is holding sham elections, making plans to use the ruble as the official currency. What are they trying to accomplish here?
Yeah, what they're trying to do here is to stitch together all of this territory that may be under a wide variety of control. It eventually could be annexed by Russia, or it could basically be presented as sort of independent, unrecognized republics. But all in all, continuing to eat into Ukrainian territory and create areas that Russia will claim are, you know, favorable to Moscow.
And you were just in neighboring Moldova, not far from Odessa, which also has a Russian-backed breakaway region. There were explosions reported there this week. Do you expect a new front to be opening up in Moldova? And what would the strategy be there?
Yeah, not anytime soon. And that's because the Russian military is already very engaged in the east, in the Donbass. And it's a long way to get across the country to Transnistria, which is this breakaway republic you were mentioning, which is not recognized by any other country, but it has 1,500 Russian troops, and it's essentially Russian occupied. But that's a long way to go, and you'd have to get through Odessa, which has already dug in, had 2 months to dig in. So I think defensively it'd be very difficult for the Russian military. But I think one thing you're seeing with the explosions is some people here and in Moldova think that it's a way of China to take attention away from what's happening in the Donbass and keep some of the Ukrainian troops near that border, just in case the Russian troops might come across or something like that. But that's, most people don't think that's going to happen. But I think it's worth watching Moldova very closely, because recently The Moldovan government banned a thing called the St. George's Ribbon, which is associated with the Russian military. And there's thought that Russian agents will try to foment protests there and try to destabilize the government in Moldova, which is just recently applied to join the European Union and not looking towards Moscow, but really looking towards Brussels and the EU to their future.
That's NPR's Frank Langfitt joining us from Kyiv. Frank, thank you so much.
Hey, good to talk, Jane.
There's new hope that children under 5 may be able to get vaccinated against the coronavirus soon. Today, Moderna asked the Food and Drug Administration for emergency use authorization of a low-dose version of its COVID-19 vaccine. The FDA is expected to consider the request in June once all the data have been submitted. Joining us now is Dr. Michael Chang, a pediatric infectious disease expert at Children's Memorial Hermann Hospital in Houston. Dr. Chang, a lot of parents are cheering at this news, but they're wondering why it has taken so long to get this vaccine for young kids.
Yes, I know it's a common question that we are getting. And I think the key to remember is anytime a new medication, whether it's a vaccine or any other medication, comes to market, we really want to ensure that it's safe and that the benefits outweigh the risks. And this is especially important in pediatric patients because, one, they're not little adults, and two, you know, they don't really have the autonomy to make their own medical decisions. So we definitely want to be sure that the benefit outweighs the risk. And so we want to be careful and very methodical about collecting data and making sure that, you know, we are ensuring the benefit and safety of this vaccination before we, recommend it and that the FDA authorizes it for this age group.
So speaking of benefits, how effective is this Moderna two-dose shot for kids under 5 compared to the adult version?
Right. So it's important to remember that with the Omicron wave, kids were infected at higher rates than with other variants and were hospitalized at much higher rates than other variants. And we also know that in adults, the Omicron variants seem to escape protection from both previous infection and from vaccination. So in adults, it was about 30 to 50% effective in preventing any infection. And so in this age group, the 6 months to 5 years, Moderna is reporting about 50% effectiveness in the 6 months to 2 year age group and about 38% to 40% in the 2 to 6 year age group. And I just want to emphasize what this number means is that for those age groups, you're still getting a 40 to 50% reduction in the risk of infection, confirmed infection, compared to an unvaccinated child.
So the three-dose shot for kids under 5 that was developed by Pfizer and BioNTech proved ineffective. It's still now under development and review. Could that end up happening with the Moderna shots as well?
So that's a great question. The Pfizer and Moderna shots are both mRNA vaccines, but they chose slightly different dosing regimens. And so for the Pfizer-BioNTech pediatric vaccine, for the age group under 5, they're actually using 1/10 of the adult dose, a 3-microgram dose compared to 30. And this was during the Omicron wave where they were trying to collect data. Now, the Moderna vaccine, again, it is an mRNA vaccine, but they have a 25 microgram dose for this pediatric age group, which is a quarter. So it's not quite as small as the Pfizer dose. You know, it's not clear that the dosing is what's making the data appear to be different. But at the same time, you know, I think it's important to remember that, yes, even though they're both mRNA vaccines, the dosing and the dosing regimen is not exactly the same.
Now, I know a lot of parents are anxiously waiting to be able to get this vaccination for their young kids, but only about 1/3 of parents of children aged 5 to 11 have vaccinated their children at this point. What's your advice to parents who are hesitating?
Right. So I think, you know, the thing is parents have been wanting to ensure that these vaccines are safe and that there aren't going to be long-term consequences from vaccination. And I think, you know, people have been uncomfortable with the idea of these mRNA vaccinations being, you know, kind of quote-unquote new things. Now, it's important to remember our body, we have tons of mRNA generally just to, you know, have natural processes in our body. And mRNA, even from these vaccines, doesn't last very long in the body. And so it's not like it's going to fundamentally change our bodies in any way. And so, you know, the other thing to keep in mind now is that we have millions and millions of doses of these vaccines being given in pediatric age groups. And we haven't seen additional safety signals apart from those which were reported with the initial data submissions to the FDA. So, you know, if you're waiting for safety data, I think these are some of the most widely administered medications across the globe at this point. We have just an overwhelming amount of safety data. You know, there's no reason to suspect based on the scientific, you know, kind of technology in there that there would be long-term effects. And again, you know, even though the Moderna data that was published today didn't necessarily have enough information about disease severity, like preventing severe illness and hospitalization, we do know that vaccines are still the safest and most effective way to prevent severe illness and hospitalization.
Dr. Michael Chang, pediatric infectious disease expert at Children's Memorial Hermann Hospital in Houston. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kevin Fredericks, better known as Kev on Stage, is part of a generation of comedians who rose to fame on the internet.
Dad joke. You know, Zay, I have another joke about paper. But I'm not sure if I should tell you. I guess I'm just torn.
Over the past 12 years, Fredericks has drawn millions of followers, performed two sold-out national comedy tours, and launched his own production studio. Here Now's Tanya Mosley recently caught up with him for her podcast, Truth Be Told. They talked about his decision to pursue show business and how he's navigated fame and faith in the online world.
Kev, we met like a decade ago at a Jack and Jill event I was emceeing in Seattle. You were the comedian, I was the host. And look where you are now. Do you remember that event?
Yes. That's when I found out about what Jack and Jill was.
Yes.
I came from a different side of town than what Jack and Jill events were on. But it's been a long way since then. And I want my kids to be in Jack and Jill. I need to find my local chapter.
You know, Kev, I'm curious. You started doing stand-up in high school at a church talent show. When did you realize that you were funny?
I realized I was funny a long time before that, when I could convince my grandma and my mom to let me stay up later by making them laugh. That's when I realized I was funny, because usually we were, you know, this is grown folks' business, go to bed, you shouldn't be around here. Once it was like, Kevin, do that shout that Sister Daniels did. Show them that shout. Once it was that, you know, it only bought me 5 or 10 minutes. But 5 or 10 minutes when you're like 7 is a win. So that's when I first realized that being funny could get me things that I desperately wanted.
Well, you're almost like an OG when it comes to comedians who have maintained this really strong presence and following on social media. But your rise in the scheme of things really happened so fast. You and your wife, Melissa, had these good jobs at Boeing. And anyone who's from the Pacific Northwest knows, like, to work at Boeing, that is it. Like, you can have a wonderful life in Seattle at Boeing.
I tell people, like, that was like getting a job at the chocolate factory. Like, it was like Willy Wonka. You get there, you don't quit. You stay until you die or they lay you off. But you do not quit if you work for Boeing. And strangely enough, we both quit and only up from there. Not immediately up, but eventually up.
Right. You made this choice with two kids, this move to Los Angeles and to do comedy. What was the moment when you said, having these really good jobs, the thing we're going to do is to quit Boeing and make this our main thing?
I can tell you exactly the moment, interestingly enough. And it's a very interesting thing. My son had a video go viral, a couple of videos go viral. And he was reached out to by agents in Hollywood to play Buckwheat in a Little Rascals remake. So I took some time away from work and took him out of school for a little while. And we came down to L.A. to shoot the Little Rascals Save the Day. And we were on set one day, And the sound man who operated the boom pole, he was on a break and he just sat his boom pole down next to his rig and he was just on his phone texting. And at that moment, I was like, wow, this is this guy's job. Like, he's just taking a 10-minute break the same way I do at Boeing or from just going down to grab a soda. It's no different than any other job. He just gets to make movies for a living. And that was the moment where I was like, I don't have to be the star of the movie. I don't have to be filthy rich. I just want this to be my job, and I want my 10-15-minute breaks to be on the sets of movies or something like that. And it was that simple, kind of mundane thing. I called my wife right after I saw that, and I was like, we have to move.
How has it been navigating your faith in this city of Los Angeles? Have you had folks ask you to be something that you're not?
You know, a friend of mine said when I moved here, and I took this statement to heart, he said, as you rise in this city will give you whatever your desires are. If your desires are women, you'll get women. If it's drugs, if it's partying, if it's alcohol, whatever your vice is, you will get it in excess. So make sure you know what you want. And I think for me, I've always been focused on maintaining my family. And that's the excess thing that I want. My excess isn't a Coke-filled party in the hills. It's taking my kids to Japan. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So luckily, I found churches that were led by creative Christians. So they understand how to navigate this industry. They work in this industry. So when your pastors, you went on tour with Brandy or worked for Death Row or worked for Kanye or Diddy, or you see those people coming to church, it's easier to navigate when they have some experience being in that industry. So that was important as well.
I mean, you carry yourself a certain way, but you have also evolved. I mean, I've been following you pretty closely throughout your career. And one thing that I noticed is from time to time, you've gotten some pushback from maybe disappointed fans who measure your, I don't know, for lack of a better word, Christianness in a way.
Yeah.
You talk about real stuff like sex and you know, other life issues. How do you manage that push and pull?
So that's a great question. Here's the truth of the matter. I'm almost 40 years old, right? Very few of us who are 40 or near 40 are the same person we were when we were 25, you know, or 30. So a lot of people have been tracking me. I had to let go of holding what strangers thought I should be close to what I thought I should be. I spent a lot of time trying to make sure strangers were happy with me. But then I realized it was like a cage, because there's millions of people, and the same thing that makes you laugh offends someone else. The same person is happy that I'm growing and changing. Another person wants me to stay exactly the same. And it was too constricting to try to live up to what million, I literally have millions of fans, millions of people think. So, and I disappoint myself all the time. So you aren't special if you're not disappointed in me. I tell my spouse I'm supposed to eat right and work out 5-6 times a week and not drink sodas and sugary drinks. And after we finish this podcast, I'm going to Starbucks and getting a strawberry acai with lemonade.
Right.
So if I can disappoint myself or my wife or my kids, you are not special enough to not get disappointed by me. You make sure that you act in a way that you should be proud of yourself. And I know whether you are happy with me or frustrated with me or disappointed, I will be acting in the way that I see fit at all times. And if you go, that's fine. Think about your favorite artists. You don't necessarily like every phase that they're in musically.
That's true.
Every movie they make, you may not like every choice they make. You may stop liking them overall. You might like their first 3 albums and hate 4 through 9. But does that mean they shouldn't be allowed to make what they want to make or do what they want to do or take their career how they see fit? And sometimes we don't like stuff for a while, and then they come back and they're great again. So I think every artist should be allowed to take their own journey and let the people who are enjoying that part enjoy, and let those who don't. And I think that's how I've been living for the last couple years, once I kind of freed myself from trying to appease and impress everybody.
Back to your Boeing days, living in Washington State, and then making this leap to move to Los Angeles. What does success look like for you now? I mean, you've got so many things going on, and yet, I mean, from my view, it actually feels like it's just the beginning.
Yeah, from my view too. I think for me, success is simple and complex. The simple part is I just want to be able to make what I want when I want and create opportunities for other people. And I think no matter how big I get, I think I will always reserve the right to create in a way where I don't have to get notes from someone. It might not be on all the projects, but I will always have either a passion project or a platform where I can say what I want. And I think as I rise and hopefully accumulate more resources, I think I always want to share those resources with people. I think one thing I'm known for is sharing my platform. You know, Keep Your Distance, I'm putting on 6-7 comedians a night, once a month, always giving opportunities with the stuff that I work on. I always try to cast up and comers or people who are not gotten an opportunity to play at the level that we can offer. And I think my hope is that as I continue to grow, I just will have more resources to give those opportunities to other people. And that to me is success. It's not about having all the money in the world or being able to do whatever. It's about being able to do nothing if you want to do nothing, being able to create whatever you want if that's what you want to do, and being able to create opportunities for other people. And by thinking of success like that, I'm always able to be thankful in the moment, because wherever I am in my career, I should be able to be doing at least that.
Kevin Fredericks, aka Kev on Stage, comedian, studio founder, host, social media star, and soon to be author. His new book with his wife Melissa, titled Marriage Be Hard, comes out September 13th. And you know we have to have you back on to talk about that. Me and my hubby have a lot to talk about with you on that.
Would love to.
Kev, thank you for taking the time.
Of course. Thank you so much. Love to do it again.
Germany is breaking from its tradition of refusing to export heavy weapons to war zones. It just announced it will send anti-aircraft systems to Ukraine. And Chancellor Olaf Scholz is under pressure to send even more weapons. But there is still anxiety in Germany over the provocation of a wider conflict with Russia. NPR's Esme Nicholson reports.
Speaking after talks about Ukraine with military officials from 40 countries at the Ramstein Air Base, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin made a point of acknowledging a last-minute pledge of support.
I wanted to especially welcome a major decision by our German host, announced just today that Germany will send Ukraine some 50 Cheetah anti-aircraft systems.
Austin refused to speculate on what else Germany might provide, but stressed that any further decisions should be made quickly.
But we don't have any time to waste, so we've got to move at the speed of war.
In Berlin, the promise of military support is viewed as a rushed bid to save face on the global stage. On domestic television, Defense Minister Christine Lambrecht defaulted to Chancellor Scholz's more hesitant stance.
Any potential decisions to deliver more heavy weapons cannot be rushed. We must take care that we do not become a party to the war.
But Scholz and co. are being forced to act. This week, the opposition proposed a parliamentary motion to approve the direct delivery of more weapons to Ukraine. Scholz's coalition has responded with a counter-motion that still favours the so-called backfill option, in which Germany provides Ukraine with heavy weapons indirectly via Eastern European neighbours who pass on their old Soviet-era tanks in exchange for newer ones from Germany. Opposition leaders accepted this proposal and Parliament is due to vote on it. There is criticism of this roundabout policy even from within Scholz's own government, most notably from the Greens. Anton Hofreiter is one of them.
To suggest that the Ukrainian military isn't skilled enough to use modern weapons is, frankly, paternalistic nonsense, considering the heroic fight it's put up against Russia so far.
despite announcing a sea change in German security policy just days after Russia invaded Ukraine, Scholz is under fire for failing to deliver the goods. The German Chancellor said last week that he's wary of sparking a nuclear war and announced military stocks are too depleted to spare any weapons. Many reject these arguments. Catherine Kluver-Ashbrook is a fellow at the Global Public Policy Institute in Berlin.
He has gotten in public discourse very dismissive of experts when it comes both to the discussion of a possible oil and gas embargo, but also when it comes to the idea of increased military aid. It's not a good look.
But when it comes to public opinion, not all agree. 68-year-old Dagmar Harker from Berlin says she's impressed with Scholz's level-headedness, even though she didn't vote for him.
Sure, we need to stop this war, but pouring oil on the fire by sending weapons is dangerous considering Russia's nuclear arsenal. We need to stop talking about victory and instead negotiate a ceasefire.
Ultimately, though, industry often has the final say in Germany. While Scholz has caved to pressure from sectors heavily invested in Russia to dismiss prominent economists who say an immediate gas embargo is manageable, the arms industry is also driving policy by pushing the government for export permits. For NPR News, I'm Esme Nicholson in Berlin.
As we look for solutions to climate change, the insights and lived experiences of Indigenous people are often overlooked. That's the argument in a new book called Fresh Banana Leaves, Healing Indigenous Landscapes Through Indigenous Science. Its author is Jessica Hernandez, a University of Washington postdoctoral fellow from the Maori Chorti and Zapotec Nations, and she joins us now. It's so great to have you here, Jessica.
Baduchi, thank you for having me here today.
So you write, quote, "While in Western academia, we are always in competition with one another, as Indigenous scientists, we collaborate because we know we are ultimately stronger together." Can you elaborate on this?
Yeah, so one of the things about like being an Indigenous scientist is that we understand the impacts colonialism has and continues to have on our people. And also, like you were mentioning, the climate change impacts that is, you know, exacerbating our community disparities. And as Indigenous scientists, we work together to collaborate on ways that we can find solutions that will holistically heal our planet as well as our people as well.
And you also write that the environmental discourse has failed and continues to fail in uplifting and centering Indigenous people's voices, perspectives, and lived experiences. What is missing from the conversation about the environment?
I think some of the things that are missing from the conversation about our environment is that Indigenous peoples are experts, oftentimes in environmental sciences or in any of the disciplines. We continue to view Indigenous peoples as areas of expertise or research subjects, whereas, you know, Indigenous peoples hold on to the knowledge that can holistically protect our environments, especially as we continue to see how climate change impacts are drastically shifting our weather patterns, our climate impacts, and seeing how we can address more justice solutions in that sense.
Tell me the story of the title. It's Fresh Banana Leaves. What is the story behind that?
Yeah, so that story is grounded on my father's experience as a child soldier during the Central American Civil War. They started, you know, using violent tactics to kind of recruit children as well. And most of the children that were recruited were Indigenous children. And my father was, you know, fortunately forced to join the guerrilla when he was 11. Mm-hmm. And during that time frame, there was a banana tree in his guerrilla encampment that he would kind of frequent, that he would talk to, that he would climb to kind of serve as his sanctuary to escape the harsh realities. You know, 3 years passed getting his training, being in his encampment. When he was 14, his guerrilla encampment was bombarded. And one of the first instincts that he decided to do was to go under this banana tree that he had built a reciprocal relationship with and consider, you know, his friend and relative. And he saw a bomb drop on the tree. And instead of the, you know, the bomb igniting, the leaves kind of wrap themselves to prevent the bomb from igniting. So my father says, right, that as long as we protect nature, nature will protect us.
You spent a lot of your younger years in South Central Los Angeles, though, and you live in Seattle now. And you mention in the book that 70% of Native peoples reside in urban environments, and yet many Indigenous people think of cities as inherently non-Indigenous spaces. Why is that?
We forget that in these cities, you know, there are Indigenous communities that are considered, you know, urban communities now because their environments have gone through these drastic changes. When we talk about Seattle, we can even talk about the history of how it was named after Chief Sealf, you know, a Duwamish tribal leader, and how the Duwamish tribe is still fighting to kind of get federal recognition. So I think that because we tend to always connect Indigenous peoples to more rural places, we forget that urban cities are also built on Indigenous lands. And that goes, you know, throughout the United States when we talk about Berkeley, California, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and these major cities that hold political and economic power in our country.
So you are an Indigenous woman in the sciences, the first Indigenous person to teach Intro to Climate Change at the University of Washington. Have you had to deal with, say, patronizing or condescending views when you start to talk about Indigenous science?
Yes, and I think that, you know, fortunately for us, the narrative is starting to shift. But oftentimes, right, we are asked, how is this science? How is, you know, where's the data, the numerical data to support these claims? And I think that for Indigenous ways of knowing, not everything is translated into numerical data sets. Not everything is published in, you know, the peer review process. And I think that oftentimes, because in sciences, we still continue to exclude lived experiences or personal narratives, it kind of continues to invalidate communities and ways of knowing that are, you know, centered on storytelling, that are centered on lived experiences, that are centered in our traditions, that are not necessarily, right, normalized in what we consider today the American society.
So you are also female, and there's a chapter in your book called Tierra Madre, Indigenous Women and Ecofeminism. How does patriarchal history and systems and misogyny, how does that make it more difficult to make change when it comes to climate change or even the Indigenous women who are working towards helping the environment or moving science forward?
Yeah, so one of the ways is that we continue to remain invisible, right? Like I even, in the book, I talk about the Zapatistas movement and how the Zapatista movement, which kind of reclaimed land for many Maya communities in southern Mexico, continues to paint the man, Comandante Marcos, as the leader, when in reality, it was the Indigenous woman who were the leaders, who were leading the communities to kind of, you know, reclaim their lands. And I think that oftentimes when we talk about environmental justice or climate justice, is the men in our communities that are continue to give, you know, the front and center and the leadership of those movements, when in reality is Indigenous women who are leading those efforts. And I think that with patriarchy, right, there's also the missing and murdered Indigenous woman, you know, epidemic that's impacting all of us across the Americas, from Canada all the way to South America. And I think that with that, when you are an Indigenous woman advocating for the protection of our Mother Earth, you're going to, you know, face more violence.
Yeah. Now, according to the National Science Foundation, as of 2017 at least, about 70% of doctoral degrees in the sciences were awarded to white people, and less than 0.5% were awarded to Indigenous students. It can't be easy to be an Indigenous student in the field. What do you wish you had known when you first began studying?
I think one of the things that I wish I would have known is that, you know, there was going to be a constant battle, especially when going, you know, when talking about Western sciences, when trying to bring in my entire self, because I think that one of the premises of our Indigenous knowledge is that it centers our spirituality. But in the Western sciences, right, in the name of objectivity, we have to remove ourselves from the science that we practice.
Can you give me an example of one Indigenous practice that you feel like should be more widespread, that more people should use?
One of the, you know, Indigenous practices that I think people should use is like our milpas, which are these holistic agricultural ecosystems that, you know, are very different from Western agriculture that tends to focus more on just one crop through, you know, monocultural societies. And I think that with the milpas, it kind of embodies the three sisters, as we consider them in the Southwest region of the United States, where we plant our corn, our beans, and our squash. And because they're relatives and they kind of take care of one another, they grow faster. It doesn't require as much as human labor as Western agricultural practices. And through Almilpas, we're able to also have that intergenerational teaching where, you know, our elders are teaching our youth and everyone participates. And it's like a communal harvest where, you know, we are taught to take what we need and not necessarily what we want to take. More of a holistic agricultural practice that we should follow, especially as we're seeing how, you know, everything is interconnected. So we're seeing how agricultural is also leading to more climate change impacts that, you know, are drastically impacting all of us now.
So you talk about the importance of cooking with banana trees, fruit and leaves in Oaxacan and Salvadoran communities. I wonder if you have a food recommendation. Can you recommend a dish to try?
I would say plátano frito. So that's like fried plantains. And I think that they're really good. You compare them with beans, eggs. And I think that that's what I'm always missing from, you know, when I'm away from my parents, because something about like the way that my mom cooks it is very delicious. So that's the dish I will recommend people to try.
You can eat those alone. You don't need to put anything with them. They are delicious.
Yeah.
Jessica Hernandez is a University of Washington postdoctoral fellow from the Maya Chorti and Zapotec Nations. Her book is called Fresh Banana Leaves, Healing Indigenous Landscapes Through Indigenous Science. Jessica, thank you so much.
Paduchi, thank you for having me here today.
When you see a can of beer, do you think of agriculture? Well, grain, an essential ingredient in beer, mostly grows on farms in the western United States. Now an alliance is building a regional grain supply in the Northeast. Andrea Shea from member station WBUR reports on how a pint of beer can support local farmland.
An industrial mill cracks kernels of wheat malt at Exhibit A in Framingham, Massachusetts, where Matthew Steinberg is co-founder and head brewer.
As a young brewer, I didn't really think about the agricultural piece of this at all. I didn't know the farmer, but I knew the supplier. But there was this gap.
Steinberg says most of the grain going into this batch of IPA is grown and processed at large industrial facilities out west, but 26% is regionally sourced from much smaller producers. He's been working to use more as a member of the Northeast Grain Shed Alliance. It's a grassroots organization with about 150 craft brewers, bakers, distillers, millers, maltsters, and farmers from six states. Steinberg says they're shrinking the distance between fields and pints of beer with a more resilient regional supply chain.
I feel like it would be irresponsible to not try to be as ecological as possible in this line of work. It's so water heavy, it's so energy heavy, and it's so farming heavy.
It's also shipping heavy, which has become more costly and less reliable, especially from Europe and the UK. Steinberg says consumers might not think about where the barley in their beer comes from. That's why the Grain Shed Alliance launched an awareness campaign. The Square Foot Project is a novel way to calculate localized beer's impact, not on our palates, but on the planet. Take Steinberg's IPA.
This beer supports about 2 to 2.5 square feet of farmland for every pint.
Steinberg makes two 100% regional grain beers that now have certified square foot logos on their cans.
I want the consumer to see the square foot logo because I want them to have a connection to us and to the farmers and the maltsters who put in all this extra work to make local beer.
So every morning, the maltster is coming out and stirring the malt by just taking
maltster
a shovel.
Maltster Andrea Stanley is standing inside a 7-foot-tall stainless steel tank filled with germinating Northeast barley. She co-owns Valley Malt in Hadley, Massachusetts.
I play the role in the supply chain of processing grain that's grown locally in order for breweries to be able to use it. So malting is this really critical process where grain undergoes a week-long journey of being soaked and then sprouted and then dried down. and it all starts with grain.
Stanley's the conduit between brewers and growers in New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine, New York, and Massachusetts. She's always trying to expand the grain market for brewers so she can contract more acres with farmers.
Most of them have certain amount of acres that make growing grains profitable for them. Growing 5 acres is probably not very profitable for most farms. Growing 50 to 500 acres is.
According to the Northeast Grain Shed Alliance's square foot calculator, 1 acre of farmland yields 8,000 pints of beer that Stanley says also help repair the soil.
When grain is farmed and land in the Northeast, it is giving that land a bit of a rest from other crops, maybe vegetables or corn or soy. It's helping to fix nitrogen in the soil. You know, there's just a lot of really healthy things about having grains in rotation on farms.
Stanley says her sustainability-driven company has grown since opening in 2010. Now it's relocating to an industrial building in nearby Holyoke that's powered by 100% renewable hydroelectric. Stanley says the square foot project and logo help communicate the alliance's commitment to the environment.
Things are burning, things are flooding. Like, if we can't get this going now, we're losing out on precious time to reverse some of the effects of climate change.
If you give somebody information, a kind of cool, fun fact, they're going to want to know a little bit more. And that's the whole idea.
Barry LeBenz at Kent Falls Brewing came up with the square foot concept. He founded his company in 2015 as Connecticut's first farm brewery. All of his beers have always been made with 100% regional malt. For him, the alliance is reclaiming a crop that grew in the Northeast before grain moved out west.
A lot of towns back in the day would have a miller, maybe a maltster, a farm growing grain somewhere nearby that supplied those businesses.
Looking ahead to the Square Foot Project's future, LeBenz envisions walking into, say, a package store.
And they have sections for beers with locally grown grains, right? And then somebody can shop and see this symbol on many, many beers.
And if it takes millions of cans of craft beer to support regional farms, LeBenz says, the Northeast Grain Shed Alliance needs a lot more beer lovers to get cracking. For Here and Now, I'm Andrea Shea.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jane Clayson in Boston.
And I'm Celeste Headley in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now.